wonderful to welcome Bob Smith here and to ask him to address us now on the topic as it is printed there in the paper, Judicial Mandates for Same-Sex Marriages in the United States of America and Religious Freedom. So, please. I haven't had an indication that Mr. Kazitu Kamangele is here. And then after Bob, it is Davina Perumal, and Yashi, she's ready.
Well, it's wonderful to be with you. I appreciate this opportunity, and I appreciate being next to my good friend, Peter Kurtzen. We've had a wonderful time working together over the past few months. As the title suggests, I'd like to take a few moments to talk about the same-sex marriage issues in the United States. Like in our last plenary session, my own research has broadened beyond simply judicial mandates, but so it will be broader than that in terms of the entire same-sex marriage debate that is going on in the United States. Both religious freedom and marriage are foundational ideals in the United States. American children are taught the story of the pilgrims coming to the Americas in search of religious freedom. This story is foundational to the American sense of identity and purpose in the world. At the same time, the notion of the traditional family, founded by a man and a woman in marriage for their mutual happiness and for the well-being of their children and the stability of society, has been fundamental in American culture, as in all other societies worldwide. However, as we are all aware, recent and rapid social changes are challenging traditional structures, changing definitions of marriage, and calling into question the fundamental right to hold and manifest certain deeply held religious beliefs. In an effort to produce more light than heat on the subject, I'd like to introduce my thoughts on the current debate over same-sex marriage. First, by briefly reviewing the religious freedom and marriage principles in the United States. After that brief review, I'd like to tell two different experiences, multi-decade type experiences, about the interaction of religion and religious freedom and marriage in the United States. And then I'd like to offer some observations about religious freedom casualties that have occurred or that may still be occurring. And finally, I'd like to offer a helpful suggestion about the path forward so that religious freedom is preserved. Religious freedom has historically been protected in the United States under the U.S. Constitution. The first provision of the U.S. Constitution in its Bill of Rights protects religious freedom by prohibiting the establishment of a national religion and prohibiting any laws that would prohibit the free exercise of religion. While religious freedom in the United States has had its share of missteps, Americans have traditionally felt pride that it is the nation where it has as its motto, "In God We Trust." And when we pledge allegiance to the flag, we aspire to be one nation under God. Protection of religious freedom for individuals and religious communities has helped make America one of the most religious countries on earth. Without government sponsorship or promotion, high percentages of Americans believe in God, say daily prayer, and show other forms of belief. Moreover, they voluntarily contribute generously, both time and means, to support the religions of their choice. This chart reflects the fact that literally hundreds of billions of dollars are donated by individuals each year to religion as well as to other charities, and over half of Americans volunteer their time to charity each year, and almost 80% donate funds. In modern times, the aspiration of religious freedom has become the hope not only for the people of the United States but for all mankind. And the people of the United States share that vision, and one manifestation of it was in 1998. Congress passed the International Religious Freedom Act, which was intended to encourage religious freedom throughout the world. While this act is imperfect in many ways, it still reflects the foundational aspiration that every person born on earth have religious freedom as one of his or her inalienable rights, provided not by government, but by a provident creator. I'd like to discuss some basic marriage facts that are relevant. Not only is marriage universally held up as an ideal, but it is uniquely tied to Americans' patterns of religious freedom. And this is done in the following ways. First, as a bulwark of individual liberty, marriage has avoided federal government control and historically and primarily been a matter of state law. Federal statutes have taken account of state marriages to provide federal government benefits, but there is no federal marriage law. Second, marriage is a matter of civil law with authority granted to religious ministers in all 50 states to perform legally binding ceremonies. By the government accommodating most persons' religious aspirations, couples are able to invite religious blessings upon their union at the same time they are lawfully wed. Civil officers may also perform marriages, but the majority of Americans choose to be legally married in a church. Third, marriage has always been foundational to society and the perpetuation of the race. Thus, the state is deeply interested in the success of each marriage and has sought to promote it through government benefits and by regulating who can be married and when marriage can be terminated. Fourth, marriage has historically been concerned with the welfare of children. For the next generation to thrive, it has long been understood that children have a need to be loved and nurtured by their parents. Importantly, however, modern changes in divorce law, for example, have permitted the unilateral termination of marriage. Among other things, this has had the effect of turning marriage into an institution more centered on adult satisfaction than with the needs of children. And fifth, marriage is considered sacred by many. Marriage is more than a mere economic or social unit. It is the best, in its best form, it's supposed to instill religious and moral values such as honesty, integrity, kindness, loyalty, hard work, and many other virtues to the succeeding generation. Now, having introduced these foundational ideals for religious freedom and for marriage, I'd like to tell two stories. First, we'll begin by discussing polygamy and religious freedom in the United States. Given the importance of religious freedom and marriage in the United States, it is perhaps appropriate that the very first Supreme Court case defining the boundaries of the Free Exercise Clause involved the definition of marriage. In the mid-19th century, a small religious group, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, announced that polygamy was a fundamental tenet of its religious beliefs. And by way of caveat, I belong to that church. For this and other reasons, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints was persecuted. From its foundation in 1830, as members of the church were forced to flee from New York to Ohio to Missouri and finally to Illinois, where a church founder, Joseph Smith, and his brother Hiram were killed by a mob in 1844. The largest group of Mormons then followed Brigham Young to the Great Salt Lake Basin, where they hoped to build a free society and able to practice their religion, which I should say looks much like the mountains here in this beautiful area around Stellenbosch. Except I'm told these don't have a snow, whereas ours do, but it's a beautiful area. Polygamy aroused the deepest sense of antipathy among the predominantly Protestant Christians of the young nation. As a result, Congress made strenuous efforts to eliminate this practice. First, it passed the Morrell Act in 1862, an act that criminalized polygamy and canceled territorial laws allowing its practice. George Reynolds, who was the secretary to Brigham Young, was convicted under the Morrell Act, and he was sentenced to 2 years of hard labor. His appeal to the Supreme Court in Reynolds versus United States became the test case for polygamy and the first religious freedom case heard by the United States Supreme Court. Ultimately, the reason it took so long to have a case was that the federal constitution only applied to the Congress. In those days, it didn't apply to the states, and Utah was a territory of the federal government, and that's why the constitution applied. Ultimately, the court determined that religious acts like polygamy could be criminalized because they violated social duties and were subversive of good order. Since monogamous marriage was considered so central to the well-being of society, the government had an overwhelming interest in eradicating polygamy, and that justified its criminalization despite the religious beliefs of its practitioners. However, when the church leaders were willing to be incarcerated in obedience to what they believed were God's commands, Congress passed the Tucker Act in 1887 to further increase pressure to stop this practice. The Tucker Act provided for the confiscation of church property. It repealed the church's corporate charter. It dissolved it as a corporate body. The act stripped any polygamists from the right to vote or hold public office. Mormon men in the territories were required to take an oath to not teach, advise, counsel, or encourage any person to commit the crime of bigamy or polygamy. To my knowledge, these extreme measures are the harshest ever imposed on any religious society in the United States. Samuel Davis of Idaho was convicted of violating these enhanced anti-polygamy laws. In a challenge to the constitutionality of this measure, the Supreme Court upheld the conviction in its second free exercise case. In Davis versus Beacon, the court said, to call their advocacy of polygamy a tenet of religion is to offend the common sense of mankind. Bigamy or polygamy are crimes, then to teach, advise, or counsel their practice is to aid in their commission. And such teaching and counseling are themselves criminal and proper objects of punishment. The property forfeiture provisions of the Tucker Act were also approved in the case of the late corporation of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints versus Beacon. In that case, the Supreme Court upheld the confiscation of all of the church's property. On September 25, 1890, Wilford Woodruff, president of the church, announced a manifesto indicating intent to submit to the laws of Congress. By 1894, Congress returned the church's property, and 2 years later, in 1896, Congress admitted Utah as a state. Now, what are some of the religious freedom implications or lessons of this 19th century battle over marriage? First, one interpretation of this battle is that the principles surrounding marriage, at least as understood by the majority in society, may be of such importance that their violation may justify stripping away basic rights of religious freedom to individuals and to religious organizations. Imprisonment, forfeiture of property, and the legal existence of entities could all be taken away. Stated differently, and slightly more positively, because marriage is so important to society, as important as religious freedom may be, they must give way when the institution of marriage is threatened. As a finale to this story, the Mormons have not practiced polygamy for over 100 years. Yet today, many Americans still associate members of the LDS Church with this practice. This story is relevant today because it helps illustrate that when marital norms are threatened, legal protections for religious freedom and possibly other rights may be ignored by those in society who feel passionately about the threatened marital status. In the extreme, many may feel strongly enough that they can commit acts of intimidation, name-calling, or even acts of violence that would otherwise not be tolerated. Now I'd like to tell another story. It also spans decades and is still being played out. It's the battle over same-sex marriage. This battle has been contentious and will probably be fought for some time to come. Of course, throughout most of history, all assumed that marriage involved only persons of opposite gender. This map is intended to recognize the original status of things when all assumed marriage involved a man and a woman. A legal challenge to this prevailing view first occurred in 1973 in the case of Baker versus Nelson. In that case, the United States Supreme Court dismissed the case out of hand, stating that it lacked a substantial federal question. In other words, the court considered the plaintiffs who had brought the case to be making such a preposterous claim that it didn't even need to be graced with a legal discussion. While only a brief skirmish, the state of Maryland apparently responded to this action, and in 1973 it made it clear by passing a law that same-sex marriage would not be permitted. I'll show in red the states that passed explicit laws banning same-sex marriage. Now, nothing occurred again for another 20 years. But then in 1993, the Supreme Court of Hawaii found that prohibitions on same-sex marriage that were implicit in the marriage law were constitutionally suspect. The court did not authorize same-sex marriage at that time, but it remanded the case for further consideration by the lower court in light of a strict scrutiny standard, a judicial standard that would make banning same-sex marriage hard to justify. As suspected, in 1996, the lower court found that banning same-sex marriage was a violation of the constitutional principle of equal protection. The effect of this ruling was stayed, however, so no marriages occurred, pending appeal to the Hawaii Supreme Court. These decisions sent shockwaves throughout the United States as people realized that Hawaii was apparently in the process of legalizing same-sex marriage. As a result, Utah in 1995, and then 13 other states in 1996, passed laws banning same-sex marriage. The concern was so significant that the federal Congress passed the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, indicating that for federal law purposes, marriage would be explicitly defined to only include the union of a man and a woman, regardless of any state definition of marriage to the contrary. It further authorized all the states to refuse to recognize any same-sex marriages, even if they were legally authorized in another state. A year later, in 1997, the Hawaii Supreme Court agreed with the lower court that the state's prohibition on same-sex marriage was a violation of the state constitution. As a result, seven more states responded to this decision by passing laws that banned same-sex marriage. Then the people of Hawaii responded to the high court. In 1998, they overturned the decision of the Supreme Court, and Hawaii then became the first state to pass a constitutional amendment prohibiting same-sex marriage. In that same year, three other states passed statutory bans on same-sex marriage, and then Louisiana followed suit in 1999. In 2000, Nebraska became the second state to pass a constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage, and Colorado, West Virginia, and California passed statutory bans that same year. As the legal challenges seeking same-sex marriage right wended their way through the courts, Nevada also banned same-sex marriage by a constitutional amendment. And then then something happened that was dramatic. In 2003, the High Court of Massachusetts became the first state to legalize same-sex marriage. In doing so, it changed the normal question asked in courts. Typically, the question had been, is there a rational basis for the law, or in this case, for traditional marriage? But the court answered the question differently and said, is there a rational basis to discriminate against homosexuals? It answered the second question in the negative. While Massachusetts became a state that passed same-sex marriage, it was only recognized in that state. The federal government and the rest of the states did not recognize that marriage. In response, more states followed suit seeking to protect traditional marriage. And due to the concern that the state high courts could do like Massachusetts and overturn these statutes, then between 2003 and 2008, a total of 27 states passed constitutional amendments seeking to ban same-sex marriage. Then in 2012 to 2014, an additional three states also passed laws banning same-sex marriage. While most states were legislatively or constitutionally rejecting same-sex marriage following Massachusetts' fateful decision, litigation became more active. In 2006, the New Jersey High Court found that there's a rational basis for preserving traditional marriage only for homosexual or heterosexual couples, but they required marriage-like benefits to be offered to same-sex couples. These so-called domestic partnerships or civil unions. Other states passed similar legislation, but for simplicity, I won't go through those. The High Court of New York also held that same-sex marriage is not required by the state constitution, and it found that there was a rational basis by the legislature in deciding to, in its words, rationally decide that the welfare of children, for the welfare of children, is more important to promote stability and to avoid instability in opposite sex rather than same-sex relationships. Of course, other courts began to disagree, finding that their state constitutions prohibited same-sex marriage. In 2008 and 2009, Connecticut and Iowa Supreme Courts both held that same-sex marriage was required by their constitutions. Then in early 2009, Vermont followed suit. Later, Maine and New Hampshire, the District of Columbia, required same-sex marriage. And so it began. One state that went back and forth for years was the largest state in the country, and that is California, where I'm originally from. In that state, the Supreme Court initially ruled that same-sex marriage is required under its state constitution. But that result was rejected by the people in a popular referendum. Proposition 8, so-called, was very contentious, and there were a lot of people that were involved in that activity, including many religious groups. Ultimately, Proposition 8, which banned same-sex marriage, passed by 52% of the vote. The disappointment of this defeat was felt deeply by those favoring same-sex marriage. Many reacted with anger and protested outside the sanctuaries of the churches most active in securing the passage of Proposition 8. Proponents of same-sex marriage began to demonize their opponents as bigots who hate gays and sought to make their claims illegitimate. The litigation over the constitutionality of Proposition 8 began immediately after its adoption. The Supreme Court of California upheld the validity of Proposition 8, and immediately thereafter, a case was brought in the federal courts seeking to have the constitutional amendment overturned on federal grounds. In the case of Perry versus Schwarzenegger, the plaintiffs brought suit against state and local officials responsible for enforcing California's marriage laws. Despite the sworn duty of these officers to defend the state constitution, which now included this ban on same-sex marriage, the governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, the state attorney general, who's now the governor of the state, Jerry Brown, and other state officials refused to defend the law. This refusal to enforce a binding constitutional law was unprecedented and seemed to threaten the rule of law as a basic foundation of U.S. democracy, especially since Proposition 8 was enacted by popular referendum. In light of this refusal, the federal district court allowed the official proponents, those who sponsored Proposition 8, to intervene and defend the law's constitutionality. The case continued, and on August 4th, 2010, Federal District Judge Vaughn Walker declared Proposition 8 unconstitutional. A divided panel of the Ninth Circuit affirmed the district court, and the U.S. Supreme Court took up the case. However, to virtually everyone's surprise, the U.S. Supreme Court did not decide whether the federal constitution required same-sex marriage. Instead, it held that the official proponents who represented the state lacked authority to do so. Despite having been certified with authority by the California Supreme Court to represent the state. The court's holding was startling because it seemed to suggest that if a government official charged with enforcing the law refuses to do so, there may be no one else capable of representing the state. He or she may therefore have a type of administrative veto over legislation. Despite the seemingly limited procedural ruling of this case, the original decision of the district court, which upheld same-sex marriage, still remained. Since no one had legal authority to challenge that ruling, the popular referendum was overturned. As a result, California became a state that legalized same-sex marriage. In the middle of this battle, something else dramatically occurred. Eric Holder, the Attorney General of the United States, announced that on February 23, 2011, he would no longer defend the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. In making this announcement, he implicitly invited parties to initiate litigation to challenge the federal ban, because he would hereafter show up in court merely to agree with those plaintiffs who were seeking to overturn the law. Shortly thereafter, in 2011, New York passed legislation to permit same-sex marriage. Then on May 9, 2012, President Obama announced that he would henceforth support same-sex marriage. The Democratic Party officially adopted support of same-sex marriage in its next party platform. President Obama was reelected in 2012, and same-sex marriage passed in four states where it was put on the ballot. The following year, seven more states passed legislation in support of same-sex marriage. And then on June 26, 2013, the Supreme Court struck down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act in the case of Windsor versus United States. Writing for a bare five-court majority, Justice Kennedy noted that the law was improper because the states had the primary role of defining and regulating marriage. What business, in other words, does the federal government have in defining marriage? While federal law of necessity had to interpret how marriage laws would impact federal legislation, DOMA went too far. The court went further, however, to state that the law also signaled, quote, disapproval of a class recognized and protected by state law. In doing so, the law betrayed animus or hatred towards those disadvantaged. This moral disapproval was unacceptable under the constitutional principle of equality, and the court found DOMA to be unconstitutional. Chief Justice Roberts argued that that opinion meant that states could still decide whether to permit same-sex marriage, but Justice Scalia didn't see it that way. He perceived that because the majority had concluded that DOMA was motivated by animus, in all future cases banning same-sex marriage, the same conclusion result and the constitutionality of a same-sex marriage ban would be overturned. Since Windsor was decided in the summer of 2013, already 11 cases on same-sex marriage have been decided. Each has agreed with Justice Scalia that state bans on same-sex marriage must be struck down. In all of these cases, the order is pending appeal, and so they haven't actually performed same-sex marriage. However, in the case, Utah was the first case that where a federal district judge indicated that same-sex marriage had to be permitted. On the day before the decision of the district court, I was meeting with the governor of the state of Utah, and we were talking about this case. He wasn't particularly concerned at that time, and he assumed that the district court would uphold the ban on same-sex marriage. Despite my efforts to explain why there was a good chance that the state would lose, he commented to me and he said, "I'm just glad that Utah is an island of tranquility in a sea of chaos." Well, the very next day, 24 hours later, Judge Shelby issued his ruling, and nobody realized he was going to issue his ruling. It was a Saturday after, or a Friday afternoon, late in the day, and he hadn't announced previously that he would issue his ruling. As a result, immediately some of the state clerks felt obliged to begin to offer marriage licenses. People lined up in the streets to be married, and the court refused to issue a stay. It went to the Court of Appeals, which also refused to issue a stay, and then finally the Supreme Court intervened and stayed the actions. But for 17 days, same-sex marriages took place in Utah as a result of that ruling. Since then, all the states that are kind of in stripes, where the federal courts have issued these decisions, have stayed their rulings. In April of 2014, the Attorney General then, these are all the cases that are pending. Then March of 2014, the U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder made another announcement. He was meeting with the Attorneys General of all the states in a national meeting. And he encouraged them to follow his example by not defending laws protecting traditional marriage. He urged them to no longer defend their laws. Since that, before that announcement and after, the attorneys general from these states have all indicated that they would not try to defend their laws. Now, this story is unraveling still, and as I got on the airplane to fly down here, the headline article in the newspaper was the governor talking about his disappointment in these other governors who had just recently announced that they would no longer defend their laws. He indicated that the following. He said, because Oregon and Pennsylvania had just recently indicated they would no longer defend their laws. And he said this. He said, a governor should not pick and choose which laws to enforce. And he said that this is a tragedy in the next step towards anarchy. Most commentators now believe that the issue will be decided by the Supreme Court. Now, what lessons can we learn from this story? First, it seems that judicial and political sentiment have begun to swing in favor of same-sex marriage. This portends other states following suit with the possibility the Supreme Court could require the entire nation to sanction same-sex marriage. Second, because same-sex marriage is now legal in many states, religious organizations are now forced to confront this practice. In the current circumstances, groups supporting homosexual rights are becoming increasingly aggressive and often do not tolerate opposing opinions as legitimate. Persons promoting traditional marriage are increasingly viewed as bigots who should be ostracized for their discriminatory views. Political leaders and judges who might want to preserve traditional marriage are increasingly afraid of threatened retaliation. And this pressure is not limited to government. Private citizens are increasingly at risk for supporting traditional marriage. For example, just last month, Brandon Eich, the CEO and founder of Mozilla, which created the JavaScript internet language and the Firefox internet search engine, was forced to resign after only about 2 weeks when a group publicized that he'd given $1,000 in support of Proposition 8 6 years earlier. A boycott was being organized against the Firefox browser, and within days, the board of directors quickly took action to ask for his resignation. In doing so, they apologized that they had waited so long. This strong backlash against those favoring traditional marriage has important religious freedom ramifications. As opposition to same-sex marriage is treated as impermissibly outside the mainstream of acceptable thought, religious organizations are increasingly pressured to either conform their views or risk a political backlash in the future. And this backlash could reach both to the members of the religion, the adherents, and to the religious organizations themselves. Just one quick example, in Canada, two of the provinces have now refused to admit graduates of a religious law school because the law school is committed to traditional marriage as part of their religious beliefs. There are many other examples in the United States. For example, a Human Rights Commission held that a photographer who declined to take pictures of a same-sex commitment ceremony engaged in impermissible conduct and was fined and had to pay over $6,000 in attorney's fees. Other churches have been penalized for not offering their facilities to same-sex couples. Professors and students have been disciplined for not accepting homosexuality in courses on counseling and so forth. And there's a long list of other concerns, which I won't take the time to go over. One thing I will mention, though, is that religious leaders are very concerned about this trend. I'll just quote a little bit from Elder Dallin H. Oaks, an apostle of the LDS Church. He said, "Today the incredible claim that laws cannot be based on religious morality seems to be gaining respectability. It is being introduced to the law in various ways, including the assertion that public debate should be limited to so-called public reason, the ideas of Rawls and others, which is defined in such a way as to exclude religious values, because religion is said to be a private rather than a public matter. A companion technique for pushing religious values off the public square is to dismiss them on the ground that they're irrational and they reflect impermissible animus or hatred." And this kind of argumentation is evident in several recent judicial opinions. These accusations of bigotry or animus leveled at those who promote adverse positions have a chilling effect on speech and public debate on many important issues. Both freedom of speech and freedom of religion are jeopardized when their advocates are disparaged as being motivated by hatred. Those who have sincere questions about the wisdom of a particular proposal will be strongly deterred from rational dialogue if they perceive the risk is being branded as a bigot or a hateful person. Okay, the path forward. This is my last slide. Many persons, religious and irreligious, are in favor of same-sex marriage. Those who oppose same-sex marriage, especially those with religious objections, should treat these persons and their views with civility and respect. But also, civility and respect should likewise be expected from those who support same-sex marriage. I think a possible analogy would be the debate over abortion in prior decades. In my view, for many years, those who opposed abortion were sometimes derided as being disrespectful of women's rights. Today, however, most persons agree to disagree on this important principle. Thus, the principle of conscientious objection is preserved, and civility is generally the rule, while an active debate over this practice continues. Religious individuals are not punished for refusing to assist in an abortion, and religious organizations are generally free to speak out against this practice. In the same way, it should be the case that religiously based views on same-sex marriage should be considered legitimate, at least for purposes of discussion and public debate. Conscientious objection by individuals and religious organizations should be preserved and should be given due respect in the public discussions that will ensue. Thank you very much.